Good morning. It is March 18th, 2022. And this morning I'm going to give you some insight into the purpose of Lavrov and Moscow's negotiations with Kiev. What the point of them are. And even though we've touched on some of these before, repetition of this understanding will lead to your sense of familiarity with it and therefore truth. Because even though you may have understood what is being said and what we're going to say, we hear so much misinformation and disinformation from the media sphere that we begin to forget things that we already know. So I think it's important the context is that the goals of this operation that we've elucidated, I hope clearly, were not to blitzkrieg Ukraine and level it and engage in a total war. And the areas that are of strategic importance include, but are also distinct from the areas that will no longer ever be a part of any type of future former Ukraine in any iteration. So, Western press continually brings up misinformation, not just about the status of the war, the nature, the causes of the war, but what is being negotiated. So, let's clarify first what is not being negotiated. All the areas that we've shared video a lot of times from Intel Slava or whatever, and we've said Russian claims this and that, but then they show sauce. They have receipts, and they show these flags going up over buildings that you can geolocate and confirm, and you can date stamp these videos that these are happening all across the cities and towns, all across Western Ukraine, Eastern Ukraine, excuse me, that will never again be a part of the former Ukraine. And why they know they can do that is that these are places where 60, 70, 80, 90% of the population, regardless of their own identified ethnicity per se, because that's a whole complex thing. That Americans would understand maybe the difference between people from Maine and the people from Texas. But at the end of the day, you're all Americans, even though in other iterations you're like, goddamn those East Coast liberals or whatever, right? You understand those differences and Heartland America, the so-called flyover country that the coastals, so we have those divisions, but at the end of the day, you're all Americans. And likewise with these different parts of Ukraine and their relationship to Russia, and so it's like that in many ways. So without belaboring that point, understand that they did not go in, to annihilate people. And knowing that the Ukrainian forces, which are recruited largely from the central and west of the country, because it's most assured that they have strongly held beliefs against the locals, they embedded themselves in civic buildings. And these were of strategic importance, of course, but it's not that the buildings themselves as structures conferred some strategic advantage in terms of the tactics of a combat, because that is, of course, going to happen. We're not in the 18th century where they march out into a field and mow each other down and stand there like toy soldiers. So the issue is that they did not let people leave. Well, they did let people leave. They let people leave that the SBU had on records as being pro-Ukrainian. So whatever that minority 10%, 30% of these places, they let them leave in the direction of the interior of Western Ukraine, but they wouldn't let people leave that were on SBU lists as being probable or likely Russian sympathizers, regardless of their surnames, like those KO names, those names that end in KO and so forth that are clearly Ukrainian names. That's not how they tell per se. It's one indicator, but they have lists of people. They have their own, you can call them like a Stasi or a Gestapo is more accurate because they love Nazis. And those SBU buildings you see getting blown up serve a lot of purposes, but among them are hard copy files of who's who. And because of that, you saw a humanitarian crisis. And because of that, you were not seeing these pro-Russian or Russian forces going in with wanton disregard for the majority ethnic or Russian sympathizing or suspected Russian sympathizing, or even people, listen how this works, people who voted, this is about elections too, people who voted, right, in the last elections that were legitimate 8 years ago, the wrong way, who voted in a way that was against NATO or against total EU integration. Those people are targeted. It doesn't matter if they're Ukrainian or if they're what religion they are. It's like those sometimes co-align and they often align more than not. But the SBU kept very, very strict lists, and those people were not allowed to leave. Why are we saying this? Because the Russian operation, they didn't encounter a surprise. The demographics of this region is known, and the mission operation and what kind of things that they would encounter and expect is not even encountering and expecting for the first time. It's even to say what they would encounter is nonsense, because the information and integration and knowledge and friends live on both sides of this. It was just a known quantity what was going to happen. So Lavrov in negotiations, there is nothing that's supposed to come out of these negotiations at all. All of these negotiations are a charade, but they do serve important purposes, but none of them include coming to an agreement. Just under, let that sink in. So Russia has procedural obligations. It has obligations. Now, some of these it no longer has. There were Council of Europe obligations regarding some things about aggression, but as of March 16th, 2 days ago, Russia withdrew from, or was expelled from, or whatever, the Council of Europe. It doesn't really matter because it's back and forth. And those obligations are no longer in effect. But that would relate more to what Russia does in the west of Ukraine. And you saw an increase of activity there. We just saw a MiG repair facility in Lviv, or Lviv, if you will. Was struck by 4 or 5 missiles. It was a Russian air attack. I don't know if those missiles came from planes or if they came from naval, probably naval, that's my guess. But anyhow, because they're having the Black Sea. These are procedural obligations, and also there are obligations in international law to meet and confer. Almost when to agree in principle to meet whenever a counterparty raises the desire to meet and to talk again. And unfortunately, or fortunately, just whatever the case may be, there's no requirement that there be the normal rules or the normal negotiations of what's called progressive bargaining. where two parties, every time they meet, are supposed to make progress towards those means. So these are actually not negotiations towards a conclusion, towards some kind of tentative agreement. No. You can just talk about, there's endless number of horizontally moving points that don't have to go in the direction of peace. It can just be new questions that have arisen that are logistical in nature, usually revolving around human rights, passages, humanitarian considerations. And of course, one side or the other wants to smuggle in some kind of dual use objects of interest that, food, blankets, things like this can be used for soldiers. And then also you can try to smuggle in things that are clearly just of military use only. But, militaries need a lot of things, and there's a lot of the normal things that civilians need, whether it's, and I know it's going to sound weird, but shaving kits, toilet paper, right? Sanitary things. So those can be used to help armies, and they allow these humanitarian corridors to be open, and they will meet and confer to talk about those. And in the news, they hear a lot about it being civilians, and that's always the cover, but everybody kind of knows that it's a lot of soldiers are going to benefit from these things. And in fairness, the sort of, no one operates with purity of arms, but the operating framework of this is that we're not, except for with volunteer brigades and mercenaries, which is a whole different category in international law. So we're talking about the considerations are procedural and they relate to the rules of war and the avoidance of war crimes and crimes against humanity. It has nothing to do with leading towards an agreement on the conclusion of the war, okay? So the second important thing in why Lavrov and why the Russian foreign ministry is engaged with talks is that they turn these into media spectacles where they keep talking about neutrality and denazification, which sound really, really reasonable, okay? And here's the conundrum. Everything has a context. So if you actually understood the causes of this conflict going back to about 20 years ago, I mean, the causes of the conflict were implicit in the nature of the way that the Soviet Union disintegrated and how Ukrainian authorities basically went against the Ukrainian people's desire to remain within a economic and political unit with Russia post-communism. And it was really, remember Gorbachev, who is widely despised by everybody today, but and he's considered either an agent or a fool of whatever, not in Russian interests. But there was a view that the Soviet Union would continue. This was Gorbachev's idea, that the Soviet Union would continue together, the 14 or so whatever republics, and that would be, but they would be, the glasnost and perestroika process would continue in a direction. So they might have changed the flag and changed things in the constitution, certainly allow a lot of things that are more like Western Europe with markets and a multi-party system. But the idea that these countries would actually become fully mutually hostile countries that could be manipulated by globalist forces was not in the stated idea of Gorbachev. Now, again, that's always disputed or argued that he was an agent, a tool, or a fool, right? But that's what Ukrainians thought they were getting into. And so we showed how the on the 30th something anniversary, 31st anniversary or however, of the referendum of March 16th, 1991 or so, that referendum was to stay with the Soviet Union, knowing that the Soviet Union itself was going in the direction of market reforms and opening up the political process towards a democratic system, where the constitution of that republic would have competitive elections between different parties, and that people's ability to own and operate private interests and businesses would increase in a direction that was similar to Western Europe. Okay, so now that's a longer context of this, and more immediately, you know, the conflict in the Donbas 8 years ago. And when you add all these things up, when you know about Kuchma, about the development of critical race theory, about teaching Ukrainians to hate Russians, which is a new thing for the past 15, 20 years, when you add all those things up, and when you look at the war crimes that were carried out, okay, then if you just take a if you just walked into the store yesterday and tried to look at the negotiations, Russia's claims that the Ukrainian state and all its educational institutions and every corrupt and agent of anti-Ukrainian interest, ultimately Western agent, whatever, all these people, when you have the context, you see that Russia's real aims are rational, which is actually not neutrality. It's actually not just, you know, what you might think denazification or demilitarization means. They actually are saying that the entire institutions, even before Kuchmaism, but from Kuchma onward, and the educational reforms of critical race theory and victim ideology, which justifies exactly type of, you know, Nazi fascism, because when you're the victim and you think you're fighting for survival of your race, then you can justify these things that you hear documented in Ukrainian media calling for the killing of Russian women and children. And that's the climate, that's the boiling temperature of this madness, of this hysteria. So that's how you understand that. But if you had just walked into the store yesterday, then it would make more sense, and it would be more understandable for you to hear Lavrov and the Russian Foreign Ministry talking about neutrality. You see? So on the one hand, we want to show people that Russia's aims are not neutrality. They must, and I'm going to use, you know, non-diplomatic terms and maybe sound funny, but they have to dominate Ukrainian political and economic life. They must be an ally that has no choice but to be an ally. And they can, over the long term, and Lavrov said today in an interview on RT, they have to build up cultural and institutional gradual things that will win the hearts of minds of Ukrainians, but that takes about as long as the process was in manufacturing the culture in the opposite direction. So it's another 10, 20 years. You see? So the use of language is used to make the Ukrainians seem insane, and they are insane. But the normal framing without the context would make Russia's demands seem insane. It's just like in an abusive family where if you didn't know the history of the abuse, if you didn't know the history of how it went back, then you wouldn't understand what was happening just walking into the household yesterday. You wouldn't understand, you know, what the attitude of the different family members was to each other. You might think that the victims were the victimizers, or that they were the misbehaved ones, and so forth. So it works like that. Also, number three. So we went one, two, three. Number three, it wastes time. So they meet all these obligations in terms of number one, procedural obligations, humanitarian stuff. They're not negotiations toward peace. It's just meeting to confer, to discuss issues as they arise in real time. Number two, to use a language to make Ukrainians seem insane, because who could be against neutrality, which is, of course, taking into account the deficit of everyone lives in the world of news today, and they don't really know the conflict going back 8 years. And if you did that, then you would see that Russia's actual aims are the only realistic ones. So, but they have to use the expression neutrality, which doesn't mean neutrality. It means a Russian alliance with Ukraine. And so the third point is that it draws media attention to this idea that people are talking towards peace, which would makes you think in a way that when sides are talking towards peace, that they somehow are pursuing their military aims less vigorously. So when people see a conflict, they see a war, we're talking about people, right? They say, oh, we want, at the very least, the leaders need to at least meet to start talking about peace because we want peace whenever we see war. We want peace, right? We don't really think about the terms of that peace. So everyone's happy when they hear, oh, there's a ceasefire or whatever, okay? So they have to do that. But in reality, it's wasting time. And it's wasting time on the part of Ukraine, which continues to lose territory in actual fact. They continue to lose territory. So in a way, the numbers of killed tanks, whatever, even don't really matter. Even, and I'm just saying, they matter ultimately because there's not infinite numbers of people and materials, right? But Ukraine's claims officially are absurd. Russia has not lost 14,000 soldiers, but they've probably lost, 20% of that or 15% of that. And that's significant, but not unexpected. So there's not unexpected, there was no lack of intelligence, surveillance, or understanding of what the contending forces would be able to do. And we've talked about how computers basically show the outcomes of these conflicts and what the numbers will look like within given ranges and different contingency outcomes and so forth. So there's no surprises about this. And Russia goes in with an expectation. And it seems very reasonable when they say that everything is going within their range of expectations. And the ferocity of resistance or whatever is a very first-person shooter kind of approach to reality. And ferocity of resistance is a question kind of like of morale or certain orders that they're not allowed to retreat, which we've seen documented. Many Ukrainian soldiers that aren't, if they're not like volunteer special elite forces or whatever, they're just conscripts that would prefer not to be in the battle. But their whole family is going to be targeted with, problems and et cetera if they try to leave the conflict. So then, finally, in meetings, the things that the Ukrainian side says, and evaluating what they're willing to do, just because in the talks it's recorded for posterity's sake. Everything that comes up in the talks is recorded for posterity's sake, and that really is part of point number one: the procedural obligations related to human rights and the avoidance of war crimes and crimes against humanity. But the posture of the Ukrainian side can be evaluated. And they're probably also under no illusion that that there's going to be peace that comes out of these talks. But the kinds of things that they say and the kinds of things that they are willing to entertain are supposed to be signals about to what extent the globalist cabal is what they're informing or enforcing on the Ukrainian leadership. Because Zelensky is a puppet, and he's not even a puppet as much of domestic oligarchical forces as much as globalist ones. So, for example, people like Akhmetov or Kolomoisky, who are oligarchs that got behind Zelensky, they're not ultimately the oligarchs in the global scale that have, enforced that have gotten Zelensky and the Ukrainian Rada to declare that Ukraine is open to is the first country that is owned by the World Economic Forum. Basically, like we are the ones owned by, this whole thing that you hear from Klaus Schwab about the type of society that it's going to be, that this is a stakeholder society. And he says, we're open to the globalist stakeholders, that this is, your country now. So he's already basically given away rhetorically and economically given away Ukrainian sovereignty. What's very fascinating about those statements is that they tend to buttress and reinforce Russian claims that they're not invading Ukraine because an invasion implies that you're violating the sovereign integrity of a state. And if a state is saying that we're not really a sovereign entity, then really Russia is invading a globalist hub and not a sovereign state. So it's not hostile or aggressive in that sense. Anyway, those are my thoughts. That's my understanding. So again, don't expect anything to come out of talks. And Financial Times just got busted for running a fake news story. We covered that one. If you scroll up, look for Financial Times or FT in the search, it'll come up. I think it was yesterday or 2 days ago. We covered that one. Anyway, so that's my general update on the diplomatic, what you should expect, and how to realistically approach that with some reach back into the history of the cause of this. Because again, on the face of it, the whole takeaway here is that Russia's demands would seem unreasonable if they were not playing games with the language at this point. So when Ukrainians say Russia's talking about neutrality, but it's really not neutrality, they actually want to control Ukraine, that's not a lie. That is not a lie. So yeah, that's but why that is being said is the nuance that becomes more and more stark in its definition the more that it's examined, and then you see that the story is actually a whole other story.